Coffee Break, where Helena comes to talk.
And a good Friday morning to you. Stuart Davis in for Troy Shockley on this special Coffee Break, as we've got a great guest for you this morning. We are going to be talking to right now Bill Woon and Ray Reed about an awesome anniversary that just took place regarding the First Special Service Force. So now Bill is involved with the First Special Service Force. His father, I believe, was a member of that elite group back in World War II. And of course, Ray, we know, is with the Military Museum here, the Montana Military Museum. So a pleasure to have both of you gentlemen in studio today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, this is a fantastic, again, a lot of people might not know about the First Special Service Forces, but it's just really, really rich history and a lot of great stories, and I hope you can share some with us today, Bill and Ray, as yesterday, the 5th, was the 75th anniversary of the deactivation of the First Special Service Force in southern France. So first off, I guess, Bill, let's open up and tell the listeners, what was the First Special Service Force?
Initially, they were an experiment. They were started in 1942, right after Pearl Harbor. There was a concept of this unconventional warfare. At that time, it was big armies fighting big armies. And the concept was to train an elite group of hand-selected men to infiltrate behind enemy lines, to be trained for winter warfare, for mountain warfare, on all different kinds of weapon systems. Their specialty was night fighting, and they used that. They utilized that on the Anzio beachhead too. But it was an experiment. There was no manual. Colonel Frederick at the time was given the task of training this international group. They call themselves North Americans rather than U.S. and Canadian. But he had to invent it as he went because there was no manual to train these.
So it's almost like special forces. It was the beginning of what we think of as kind of special force units that they drop in, maybe black ops in modern warfare today.
It is. They are the forefathers of the special forces, of all the special operation forces throughout the United States and Canada. It started here in Helena.
Yeah, over at Fort Harrison, they were doing a lot of the training for this. So let's talk about how they – I heard that the guys that they brought in didn't even know where they were being taken. They were on blacked out windows and trains and being brought here to train
many of them
in Montana. Can you talk about a little bit about that, Red?
Well, what they did is they put out the request throughout the services of people who want to join this unit. They promised them quite a future, but they couldn't tell them what it was. And I can remember Mark Radcliffe, who was one of the force members. He was at OCS in at Fort Benning, and he was called into an office and was accepted. That afternoon, he got orders, and he goes on a train, and he was headed to Montana. He didn't know. He met people on the way that were all coming here. So when they got here, they didn't know what they were doing. In fact, I think Mark said that one of the other guys decided to drive – take a taxi out to Fort Harrison and see what it was, and he didn't come back for a long time, and they were really worried about it. But the group was half Canadian, half American, ultimately, and most of them arrived by trains, and we had a train depot on Fort Harrison at that time, so they would come pull right up onto the property. But what they did is almost all the trains that were hauling troops were blacked out. And they didn't want people to know who was on the trains. And at that time, they were just, you know, trying to get everybody organized.
As far as though people from around the country came, but they also ended up tapping into the rich resource of Montanans and ranchers and farmers and some tough individuals that were already in this area as well that signed up, didn't they?
We have met a number of people who were actually from Montana. They looked at that, the strength of the rancher, the logger, the person who had climbed the tree or whatever it was, and used his own ingenuity to persist. Well, I keep thinking of this. This was a called by Frederick was called a suicide force. He recommended not to do it. He ended up being the commander of it. But he said what was going to happen was they were going to be able to get in wherever they went, but they would probably never come out. So they expected the force to be totally expended or nearly totally expended by the time they were finished.
Were the soldiers aware of that when they signed up?
They were.
Wow. Now again, why did they choose Montana? Was it because of the terrain and the climate conditions?
Our National Guard had left the fort in 1940. The fort was basically empty, and they were looking for a place that was a secret location that had all those attributes, railroads and transportation, so they could get people here. It had the mountains. They found out it had the mountains. It had the water. It had everything that they needed to do so they could train completely off the land here. And they trained all over Montana, as far up as Libby, far as down, I think probably down by the Idaho border, all over. They did that. They figured out things that nobody else knew. They trained on new equipment like the Weasel. We had the first 120 here at Fort Harrison. We still have one on display out there. They were developed by the Studebaker Corporation, and they were all, everything was leading RD kind of things. But the thing that they said was, when you run out of your own ammunition, your own weapons, pick up the enemy's weapons. And that's what they did.
Now, Bill, your father was one of these individuals on this cutting-edge technology and warfare and this newly evolving strategies. How did he get involved with that and you know, get, I guess, selected for this elite service?
He was in the Canadian Army. He had been a hard rock miner when he enlisted, so he had spent a lot of time working around explosives, demolition. He enlisted. He was in the Royal Canadian Engineers. And when the call came out in Canada for volunteers for airborne training and for this special training, he volunteered.
I don't think people, and I don't mean to cut you off, but airborne training, because, you know, it was so new, having airborne, telling somebody, you know what we're going to do? We're going to fly you over a country, and we're going to drop you out of an airplane. I mean, jump with a parachute. What's a parachute as far as these? It's so new, I don't think, I guess really just explain how cutting edge it was at the time for these young guys to take on such, I guess, daring missions.
It was new. In fact, a lot of the technique that Special Forces and Airborne use today was actually developed right here at Fort Harrison. That was one of the first tests when they landed here in Helena. Dad came down. He came across Canada to Calgary, and then they brought him down on trains and dropped him off here in Helena. They had no idea where they were going. But what enticed him was a little extra pay, airborne pay. Once you got your wings, you got a little bump in pay. But one of the first tests of the men when they got here was were they able to jump out of an airplane? Airborne training at that time at Fort Benning was about 5 weeks. These men got 5 days, wow, and they had to jump twice. And if they didn't jump, they were sent back to the unit that they came from. So that was one of the first psychological tests where they, if they were able to do that, then they thought that, well, we can teach them to do, train them to do other tasks. But airborne training, again, is as it's seen today, the techniques today, a lot of that was developed right here at Fort Harrison.
And no pun intended, but on the fly.
On the fly.
And as far as the rigorous training and testing these gentlemen went through, it was almost like a one-shot deal. It was very selective. A lot of people did not make it through the training process.
You know, I've never seen anything in writing, but I was told by Mark that there were about 16,000 that volunteered and 2,200 that actually made the cut.
Holy cow.
So it was very select, very hand-picked. And the training, the conditioning, the all of the tests that they had to pass in, and they were given 5 months. Colonel Frederick was given 5 months to have this unit combat ready to go into Norway, was what their initial mission was.
I remember one other aspect of it. Every time they were given what they called Army Readiness Test, we know it today as Army Readiness Test, but to test people to make sure that they're overseas, they blew the top off of the scale, and they would raise the scale, and they'd still do it. And they were so well trained, they were worried if they let them go back into the units, because in October of 1942, they pulled that mission that we were that they were going to go on. They pulled the mission, so they went and looked for other missions, and that led them on through Alaska and into Europe, through Africa, and all the way up to France.
Well, what was the one of the first missions? Where were they deployed first? Is there a timeline how they got deployed?
The development of the force was actually around a project called Project Plow. And it was a mission to go into Norway and destroy the heavy water plants and the hydroelectric plants. Now, at that time, Germany was ahead of the world in what they call the super bomb, which was the atomic bomb. But they had to have the deuterium from the heavy water plants to refine the uranium. But that their training, you know, and Ray alluded to that, there was never a provision for replacements. When my mother and father were married, he was from Canada, so he had to get permission from the Canadian Army to get married. His commanding officer told Mom that there was a 90% chance that he wouldn't be coming home.
Man.
So the attrition rate was estimated at about 90%. 10% they thought might make it home.
This is absolutely fascinating. We got to take a quick time out. Can you guys stay after the break and we talk more about this? And also the memorial that here in Helena, I don't know if a lot of people realize, came from the first Special Service Forces, and we're going to talk about that as well. So much to get to. Ray Reed, Bill Woon here talking on Coffee Break. We'll be back with more.
I just wanted to step away from the show for a few seconds to tell you that if you miss an episode, you can always catch up. We're on iTunes, so find our show there or swing by coffeebreak959.podbean.com. Local and area events, city, state, and national officials, your neighbors doing incredible things. We talk to them all on Coffee Break, where Helena comes to talk.
In today's always-on world, your business demands a simpler approach to network security. At Blackfoot Communications, we deliver state-of-the-art security solutions, from the perimeter to endpoint devices and remote data backup, for businesses across Montana. Ensure your company's network is online all the time. For more information, visit goblackfoot.com/security.
And we're back here on Coffee Break, and it's just fascinating. We were talking in the break. I've got Ray Reed here with the Montana Military Museum and Bill Woon here, part of the first Special Service Force anniversary, and just the fascinating stories about really the genesis of Special Forces in our United States military. And, of course, Bill's father was a part of that genesis with the first Special Service Force. Now, we know they came out to Montana. They've been trained, rigorous training, very selective, elite group. It was a different individual, a very tough physically and mentally individual that they needed to go. And now they're over. What type of missions are they doing when they get over in World War II?
Well, I don't know that the military at that time really understood what they were trained for and what their capacity was. So they were used for a lot of shock missions, tip of the spear kinds of missions. It was in Anzio that they actually utilized most of the skills that they had trained here for in terms of that night fighting and the hand-to-hand combat and the close-quarter combat. But their first mission, their first assignment, they left Helena on April 6th of 43, went out to the East Coast for amphibious landing training to add that to their skill set, and then jumped on the trains, went all the way back to San Francisco and boarded ships and went up to the Aleutian Islands. The Japanese were occupying several of the Aleutian Islands. But that was a dry run. Their assignment, their mission was Kiska Island, and when they landed, a night landing, amphibious landing, they found that the Japanese had left under the cover of fog and darkness. So they came back to the States, and General Mark Clark was fighting up the boot of Italy and ran into what was called the Winter Line, which was mountains, the Apennine Mountains, and they didn't have any units with the skills to fight in that environment, excuse me. So they called the force over, and that's where their initial combat was a mountain called La Defensa.
And now this was a well-fortified area where the U.S. troops were being fired down. The positioning of the Axis forces were firing down and pinning down the U.S. armed forces. So this group, the first Special Service Force, was brought in to help take out that Alpine unit,
correct.
Was it?
Correct. The Germans were occupying all of the high ground, and they were controlling all of the movement in the valleys leading up to Rome. And they couldn't, the Allies couldn't push the Germans off, either through aerial, they were bombing them with artillery, they just couldn't, they were dug in so well that they couldn't push them off. So they had to have boots on the ground up on the mountains to push these Germans off, and La Defensa was the southernmost point of this winter line. They had attempted for several weeks to push them off with high casualties, and the force came in. They landed on November 19th, and their assault on the mountain was December 3rd. The movie The Devil's Brigade, that was the mountain. But they went up the cliffs on the north side.
I was going to say, explain to how they you know, traversed these conditions, and it's extraordinary the measures they took to get position to actually attack the German forces.
Well, they trained here in Helena for mountain warfare and for climbing cliffs, and so they were well adapted to. They used to go out to York and climb those limestone cliffs out in York and over, you know, over by Gates of the Mountains. So they were well trained, but the amazing part was the Germans weren't defending the northern face. And just to get a visual, Mount Helena, if you kind of visualize Mount Helena on a smaller scale and those cliffs facing north, that was what they faced. Those cliffs on La Defensa were about 200 feet.
Wow.
And they had to go up the cliffs with ropes, with 100-pound packs on their backs to get to the top. The Germans didn't think that there was any way that there was any unit to get enough men and supplies up on the cliffs or up on top to put up any kind of an offensive. So they didn't defend it. So that was the route that the force took. And they actually cleared that mountain in about 4 hours.
My goodness. And so when they get there, though, they end up laying in the snow for hours on end so they can move unseen when the sun goes down to get in position to make their attack. Isn't that correct?
They went out on December 1st and basically marched all night, about 10 miles, rain and snow and mud, to get to their first base camp, bivouac, the morning of December 2nd, but they were right under the cliffs. They could hear the German soldiers talking up above on the cliffs. They could smell what they were cooking for dinner. And they had to lay there in the cold and the snow and the wet that entire day. There was enough cover at the base of those cliffs that they weren't seen. If they had been seen down there, it would have been over.
Right.
It would have all been over.
Right.
So they laid there all day on December 2nd. And then the night of December 2nd, they started the ascent up the cliffs. And they had about 200 men on top on the morning of December 3rd when the attack started. And within 4 hours, they had pushed them off Ramatania. The Germans were caught completely by surprise, had no idea they were there.
And this was the first of many of these expeditions. And like you were saying, Ray, they became feared. Hitler feared these groups of men because they would come in. And they also, they painted their faces black, that I understand. But they were, and they were given a nickname as well, I believe.
It was we're called the Devil's Brigade. We know that today is the Devil's Brigade, but, and I cannot utilize the German term, but the Germans hated them, especially at Anzio, and that's where that really came through, because they went across that Mussolini Canal from the edge of the water, and they would go out and raid and recon where the Germans were located, and they did silent kill on a lot of the people that were in bunkers and stuff like that. They'd leave the worst is yet to come stickers on their chest or on their helmet or whatever else. And maybe two people survived and one died in that. Well, what that did is it just put the fear of the Germans were really fearing them. And whenever they tried, they had fines or
they got
bounties. They had bounties out on getting somebody from the force so they could find out what these people were. They $10,000, $20,000 or whatever in lira they were trying to get. And Mark Radcliffe was captured on one of those raids, and he escaped twice.
Wow.
To come back to his line. So we have there's so many stories.
It seems like, I know it's a Hollywood movie and it's kind of fiction, but Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, I don't know if you're familiar with that movie or not, but it's a special unit that goes in and does this in small numbers to take out Nazi units. And it seems like that was where maybe he got his idea, was from this group of U.S. military.
Yeah, I think that's a very stylized area, but if you noticed in that movie, there was actually somebody wearing a force patch.
Really?
On one of the, you know, then as soon as I saw that, I said, oh, guess what? Another story is unfolding here. So
now, again, these gentlemen, they were trained in mountain warfare, but like you say, amphibious, they were utilized all over the theaters throughout the war. Where else were they deployed?
Well, following the mountain, what we call the mountain campaign, they went in on December 3rd. They were relieved on January 16th. They went in with 1,800 men, and there were 500 men standing when they came out of the mountains.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, those weren't all killed. The conditions, the environment, the weather, wounded. A lot of them were wounded and came back. They were given 2 weeks of R&R, and then they went into Anzio. And Anzio at that time was what I'll call an end run, to try to pull the German soldiers off of this winter line so that they could push up the boot, because the objective was Rome, the liberation of Rome. And for 99 days, like Ray was saying, they conducted these night patrols and infiltrated behind enemy lines. There was about 1,200 men when they got to Anzio. They were facing the Hermann Göring division of 12,000 men on the other side of the Mussolini Canal. Colonel Frederick knew that he couldn't go toe-to-toe. So they started these night patrols and night invasions and infiltrations to give them the impression that there was many more soldiers than there really was. If the Hermann Göring division would have known that, they could have run over them at any time. When they got there, the defensive line was about 100 yards. And at the breakout on May 23rd, the 1st Special Service Force had pushed them back almost 4 miles just through these night patrols. And the Germans kept moving back and moving back and moving back.
It's amazing, because it's modern warfare at the beginning, because that's how it's deployed now. It's you take these smaller units and you go and you attack these specific targets. And they were doing this 50, 60, 70 years ago. And just 25 years before that, people were entrenched in trench warfare. How much it had changed just in a couple of decades to this modern style that we're still utilizing, 80 years later. It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, the Army's grand tradition was always large war. And so these small actions, they utilized them, but they didn't like them, never have liked them. And so that's why we are now talking about the 75th anniversary of their being disbanded, is the fact that Army wanted big operations again, and they had no use for a small unit like that. But if you take that, when they took the Canadians back to the Canadian forces and they took the Americans and they went on to other things, they did the same thing all the way through the end of the war. Many of them, like I said, were utilized for special missions. We find more of these little stories coming out now, special missions going behind the lines, two or three people finding identifying the enemy's weaknesses. So, and then of course half of the unit actually did the mission into Norway. At the end, they ended up being an occupying force, and they were charged to take all of the German and Russian POWs, the German soldiers and the Russian POWs that were in there, get them all back to their right places and take the weapons away and settle the issue in Norway. So
yeah, and we could talk about this for hours on end. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. A couple of things I want to get to before we close up. Your father, he made it through the entire war.
He did. He passed away several years ago. He survived the war and came home. My mother was from Cutbank, and so he came back to Montana after the war.
Okay.
But he has been gone for several years.
Okay. Well, thank you for his service. One other thing before we go. The quick story about the 1st Special Services Forces Monument in Memorial Park here in Helena. I think it's a neat story I don't think people know about. Could you guys tell the story of that?
what happened was on their way to Kiska, they became aware, they got a radio message on the ships that the USS Helena had been lost in the Kowloon Gulf on July 5th. So they're on ship someplace going towards Alaska at that time. They task everybody on the ship to put so much money aside to buy a new keel, a new ship. And I think they raised around $5,000. They sent that money back to the Navy Department. Navy Department didn't want that, so it ended up in an account that they were managing. And in 1947, guess what? They decided they're going to do a monument, and it's right here in the middle of Helena.
It's a fantastic story. Yeah, they were taxed on all card and craps games is what the sheet says. So when they were doing a little poker playing on the side on their way to wherever they were going to do some fighting, there was a mandatory tax, and then it got put together, and that's how this wonderful monument was built here in Helena. Just fascinating stuff. We do appreciate you guys coming in today. And again, it was the 75th anniversary of the 1st Special Service Force. Their last parade just took place. Now, this disbanded in December 5th, 1944, over in a village in France. Is it Villeneuve? Is that how you say that? How do you say that, the French town?
Villeneuve-Loubet. But the commander couldn't say that, so it's
can't either.
Menton was the closest one, so they call it Menton Days.
So they just had a ceremony at Fort Lewis yesterday. Mm-hmm. They still do that every year, and I know that they had one in Canada at one of the bases up there. If you're really interested in that story, come on out to the Montana Military Museum. We're open on Thursdays from 9 to 4. We can also schedule special tours, but just please come on out. We're in the book. You can find our address. Just come on out and enjoy.
Well, Ray Reed of the Montana Military Museum and also Bill Woon, thank you so much for joining us on a coffee break today. That's all the time we have for this episode. I'll be back on Monday with Leo Dutton, so make sure you tune in there. Have a great weekend.
I'm Troy Shockley, and that's it for Coffee Break today. Be sure to check us out on iTunes, head on over, give us a review there, that's always much appreciated, or swing by coffeebreak959.podbean.com. Thanks for tuning in, we'll see you back here tomorrow.